Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture.
From the pool to the boardroom. The Olympic mindset behind winning in business. Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Adrian Morehouse, MBE, three-time Olympian, former managing director of Lane 4, and a leader in the world of high-performance culture. We'll explore how Adrian turned elite sporting principles into a successful business career, what it takes to build great teams, and how mindset drives growth. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Adrian Morehouse to the studio. Adrian is an entrepreneur and an elite athlete. And I think you're the first person in our studio, Adrian, who can justifiably claim both those things. Adrian represented Great Britain in three Olympic Games as a swimmer in 1984 in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. in 1988 in Seoul, Korea, and in 1992 in Barcelona in Spain. And Adrian, you won a gold medal. I'm still cheering. I remember in the 100-meter breaststroke, the 1988 Seoul Olympics, and you set a world record for breaststroke 100 meters in the 1989 European Swimming Championships. Since then, I mean, after it says here retiring, but retiring for a sporting career at 28. Yeah, it was unlike you went on and co-founded a company that I know well called Lane 4. You did that in 1995 and became a highly respected leadership, coaching, and performance consultancy that you later sold to Ernst & Young in 2021. So, two amazing careers. And I want to sort of have a chance to talk to you a bit about both and then. We'll conclude with what you're up to right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So good. Thanks for coming in, Adrian. So let's start. You know, how did you become a swimmer? How did that happen? And where did you grow up? Why did you become a swimmer? And obviously a very good one.
So, yeah, but no longer an elite athlete. It's quite, you've got an ex-elite athlete in the room.
I think once you're an elite athlete, you're always an elite athlete.
I'm not sure. It all fades a bit, doesn't it? Anyway, but yeah, no, you're right. So, I grew up in Bradford in West Yorkshire. Parents and one brother, younger brother, and I swam because, as a parent myself now, getting your kids to swim to save their lives when they fall in. Lots of canals, lots of rivers around Bradford area. And it was basically who learned to swim. We both went to learn to swim, me and my brother. And then once we could stay afloat and not drown, the swimming teacher ran a swimming club as well. And she said, look, if you fancy racing or you're learning butterfly and things like that, then come along to the club. So that difference between, if you like, learning to swim for save your life and then moving into a club was a natural one because it was the same lady that did both.
Right.
So by the age of 9, I was racing one length backstroke.
Right. Okay.
In the Airedale and Wharfdale Championships.
So it saved your life in more ways than one. Well, start in life.
Yeah, it was. But interesting because my father was, he was a sort of a sports person, but amateur soccer and cricket. So sort of those traditional men's sports, if you like. But so swimming was a bit of an anathema to him. So when I started to say, like, I don't want to do the cricket thing, I don't want to do the rugby thing, I don't want to do football, if I'm not that bothered about all those things, I just want to get in the pool. He went, oh, that's fair enough. It's at least it's a sport. So he was quite happy about that.
Right. So you told me, and I think you've been open about this, that you went to the pool in part to get away from folk.
So fast forward a little bit. So I was secondary school, didn't have such a great time, 12, 13, you know, sort of bit of bullying. And so for me to escape into a swimming pool was quite a good thing, you know, to get away from everybody, get my head down for a couple of hours. And also the other thing was, as an independent school where, you know, there were rugby teams, cricket teams, and being selected felt quite subjective, you know, the teacher.
Right.
I mean, I probably wasn't very good.
Do they have those lineups?
Indeed, and I'm the last person standing, you're not in anything, so I'll see you later.
That's kind of bad for confidence.
Exactly, so it's okay, I'll rather be in a clean swimming pool anyway, so rather than getting beat up on a dirty rugby pitch. So that's kind of my background. So I sort of escaped, and I was more in control of my own destiny. So I felt like being selected for something was very, as I say, subjective, whereas if I went in the swimming pool and won the race, they'd got to pick me.
It's a bit like being an entrepreneur, interestingly. You sort of, master of your own destiny if you do well.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because I think that there is a point where you have to, and I've said this before to people, where you have to flip from trying to do it all yourself. So I knew at 13, 14, and that whole drive was coming from a very personal desire and I wanted to do it for myself and prove to myself or other people. And I think sometimes in entrepreneurship, that's the same sort of thing. You've got this drive, but it's not until you realize you've got to, and you need other people to work with you and be part of that journey that you actually are the most successful. So I did okay until I was about 20. And it wasn't until I realized I needed to have the support of other specialists and other people.
As a swimmer.
And then that transferred into business for me. So
you say you did okay until you were about 20. What happened then? You got a team around you? Or?
Yeah, no. So at the age of 20, I made my first Olympics. I mean, there's lots of fast forwarding here. So I went from the county champion through to...
You went from learning to survive and not when you fell in the canal to your first Olympics.
So lots of hard work. And I was training in Leeds at that point, which is an Olympic club. And I think that I got to that point by my own grit, determination, hard work. And I had obviously had talent, but I came fourth in those Olympics. And I was only 19.
That's in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, yeah. And
I mean, you're understating it, perhaps. I mean, you have to get up really early and train really hard. And I mean, it's an incredibly focused, tough thing to do.
Swimming is a commitment. And I notice a lot of the sports now. I mean, you see some of the sports and the effort you put in. But I was up about 5 o'clock in the morning. Most mornings every week before school, Dad would drive me to the pool.
I mean, not many teenagers are doing that.
No. And I think it's about, but again, it's something that burns inside you. So I think you've talked to lots of people, I guess, in situations of entrepreneurship or drive or achievement where there's something burning inside you that doesn't go out.
Right.
And so you're prepared to put the work in. So that whole idea of, people used to say, you must have made lots of sacrifices, but they're never sacrifices at all. They're all choices. I knew what I was choosing to do. So I was choosing not to go to that party with those friends because I was going to swim because I wanted to win the Olympics. At the age of 15, I was going, okay, that's where I'm off.
So that's the thing that's burning inside. Where does that come from? What is that?
I don't know. It's interesting. My brother has the same sort of thing because I know he's done quite well in business as well. So, and my father was a role model to us. So he left school at 14. We were obviously alive at that point, but worked his way through, like in Bradford, as a wool merchant, and made his way and made it to a company director. And we saw him working hard and getting things, achieving stuff. And so there was almost like this link between you work hard and you get on. And so that sort of drive was there. But then I think my self-esteem was a bit lower when I was in my teens. And so finding something to feel good about mattered to me. And so I think that drive, I was not a happy child. And so I think that finding something to make me a little bit happier was important. So, but then I've realized that achievement alone doesn't make you happy. So it's taken me a while and I got that by the end of my swimming career.
But it's a good distraction in the quest for achievement. So you did really well in Los Angeles. You came fourth. Not well enough, obviously. I can see your expression. And that's no good at all.
Well, no medal.
Quite. Okay, you did really well. But then you needed to do better, obviously. Yes. There's fire inside you. So what did you do then? Recruit a team around you?
Almost like my coach, my swimming coach, was very open-minded, very curious, and as a value, it's one of my strongest personal values. And I think I've learned that by being around people who have genuinely been interested in other people and what's a different way or a better way. So he was of that ilk. And after the 1984 Olympics, it was a case of, look, we need to look at nutrition, psychology, physiology, biomechanics. And this was very early days of that stuff. I mean, now there's a preponderance of specialists that can support athletes. But in those days, we had to go find them. You know, we had to go to Leeds University and find a nutritionist and working with somebody who could bring different types of tools to the party other than the swimming ones. You know, it's okay, you can swim up and down. He can teach me how to do technique. But also, and I can work hard. But ultimately, there's a far greater number of inputs that are required to be faster.
You mentioned nutrition and psychology were the main ones, and then
biomechanics.
And then
strength and conditioning. So
strength and
conditioning. Because in the old days, you used to get some weights and try and get as strong as possible, lift as much as you can. But actually, that's not very good if you want to swim. If you're swimming for 2 minutes in the water, because whatever strength you've put on, you have to carry through the water.
Right.
But if it's not useful, it's wasted. So
you just want the muscles you need to
And that's power, that's applied strength. And so really understanding the difference between just being strong and actually applying that strength over 2 minutes is a very different activity, and somebody needs to help you work that out. And then how you then train for, and then interestingly, the dynamic between nutrition and physiology and strength and swimming, because you need to eat a certain way. And then if you're going to do that particular session in the swimming pool.
How did they change your diet? You remember?
I remember a moment when the nutritionist came to my mum, to my the house, where my mum, a proud Yorkshire woman who was feeding her boys very well. And this nutritionist said, well, maybe you want to give them more pasta and more carbohydrates. Right. So, because we were training so hard, I was burning off 8,000-9,000 calories a day. So they're going, look.
That's a lot of pasta.
It's a lot of cakes. And she said, no, not the cakes, but the pasta. So, so a bit of a shift to understanding and protein. And so really just we were educating. And as I say, my mum was a bit resistant at first, but then got with the program sort of thing. And she's great. And so we worked on that. So it becomes a part of your life.
What if doing good was the smartest business move you'll ever make? I'm James Reid, CEO of Reid. In my new book, Karma Capitalism, I reveal how being a Philco, that's a company where at least 10% of shares are owned by a charitable foundation, has become our business superpower. Companies like Lego, IKEA, and Novo Nordisk share the same Philco identity. These businesses last longer, inspire loyalty, and make a bigger impact on society. This book is part manifesto, part practical guide. Karma Capitalism is available now at karmacapitalism.org. Being a good business is good business. So when you went to Seoul, Korea,
yes,
what do you think your chances were of winning?
I felt good about them.
Because you felt prepared by this team and by your preparation.
And I'd had some good successes on the way. So I'd won the US Open, was in January. I just missed the world record in April, also in the States. I raced most of my rivals and I beat them all the way through. So I was going into the race as world number one.
Right.
And
so that brings its own pressures.
It does. And yet, I've been always very philosophical about these things. It's always good to be in the number one position, because then people... Because you're in it. It's
so
yours.
This is what the mind yes, sort of training taught you, in a sense.
Absolutely.
Because it's good to be in the number one position because you're in it.
Absolutely. Because
Why would you want to be in any other position?
Because everybody else wants to be in it. When I was third or fourth,
what I'm going to wish about? I was not. Exactly. You're in it. That's
but you know, but like you knew it. They were gunning for you. You definitely knew you're after you. But then it was a case then of delivering that potential. But then the Olympics is a very interesting thing, because you get literally... Once every 4 years, you get a 15-minute window to do it. Yes. And if you miss that window and you don't do it, then there's another 4 years. Yes. So that's the pressure that comes with, it's okay knowing you're the best in the world, but you have to deliver it at that time, on that day, in that swimming pool.
So the preparation to get you there has to be very precise.
Indeed, yeah. And they do, you call it a taper. So you basically, the workload tapers down. So you're trying to rest as much as you can, but maintain that fitness and strength that you've got from all that hard training. So it's called super adaptation, if you're interested.
Super adaptation. No, I am interested. That's why I'm asking this question. So you had a great triumph in Seoul, Korea.
Yeah, that was good.
Even you must be happy with that.
I was happy with that, although I only won by 1/100 of a second. It was a very tight margin.
1/100 of a second?
Yeah, it was a very tight margin.
Oh, you thought it should have been more. You're very hard on yourself.
I am, yeah.
So then you went and competed again, and you didn't win again.
Indeed, yeah.
What was that like? I mean, I suppose we all in our careers, you know, we peak and then we go, whatever the career is. But for a young athlete, this happens pretty fast.
Yeah, and I guess hindsight is a good thing when you sort of look on your full career. And so for me, all the way through to 92, so 88, I won the Olympics. I broke the world record, 89, 90, 91. I was still world number one. Right. So it's only the year before the Olympics I started to tail off. Now, I wanted a third go. I mean,
it's amazing to have done three.
It's a great show. Yeah, to go to it and have a go. I took a risk and I changed my preparation. I went to Australia and I was swimming very, very well through to May, June. And I thought, this is going to work. But my final, you said that getting it right on the day, my final taper, I changed it and it kind of went wrong. And the week before,
Why did you do that?
Because I wanted to blow the world record out of the water. It was my world record. I thought, well, I'm going to win the Olympics.
You wanted to beat yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. We're getting the impression you're a very competitive person.
Go out on the back. Well, I've toned it down. I'm very different now.
No, well, this is good. So you wanted to beat yourself, but you misjudged it.
And I misjudged it. What
happened?
Came eighth. But that's the risk you take.
You know? So you must have felt pretty sore about that at the time.
I did. But interesting that I've always been... Hindsight, and also quite a few things happened to me in between 24 and 28 that caused me to be a little bit more reflective and philosophical about life, right, and realize that swimming didn't really matter. Because one of my main rivals through my 18, 19, through to about 25, through to Seoul, died at the age of 25.
Oh, really?
In a hit and run accident.
In a hit and run, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So a guy called Victor Davis. And so facing into things that are bigger than going in the swimming pool and plodding them down for two lengths, it started to make me realize that I was trying something, yes, yeah, impressive. It's hard and it's challenging, but on the grand scheme of things, does it really matter? So it gave me a sort of...
You had a different perspective.
I had a different perspective. And I think that I've thought about that, not much recently, but about whether that changed the dynamic of me in the pool. But going for the risk, and because I knew what I was risking by changing my preparation. Yeah. But I genuinely thought, you know what? If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Well, that's very entrepreneurial as well. Yeah. You know, so aiming high and trying something.
Yeah,
and if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. You try again or do something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Failure is a signpost, as we've been told on this podcast.
Well, for me, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's why I learned all my stuff when I failed.
So then you subsequently to your swimming career started a business that you called Lane 4. Now, I think this has a meaning to swimmers.
Yes.
Why did you call it Lane 4, Adrian?
Well, it's just a quick segue. I had the 4 years after swimming, I worked for the Swimming Association, the governing body, as a director of talent development. So I actually did 4 years planning the national talent strategy for swimming.
Oh, so you're helping bring in other
swimmers. Yeah, so identifying talent development and think about the plans so we weren't burning kids out. So that got me into talent development, which is why Lane 4 as a talent, human resources kind of consultancy came about. So it's an easy segue when you know that middle bit.
Yeah.
But Lane 4, I started with a friend of mine who was a sales director and a couple of sports psychologists. And it was one of the sports psychologists that threw that name into the hat when we were calling out names. You know, we had some of the rubbishy names, just sort of the general names like peak performance or go fast or whatever. And then this guy said, well, how about we call it Lane 4? We all looked at him and went, well, that's a good one because it is the lane that the fastest qualifier from all the prelims goes into. So it's the favourites lane. Oh. Ultimately, it's the one where you're more likely to win.
And is that because you can see what's going on either side of you?
Yeah, I mean, in the peripheral vision, helpful because you've got three on one side, four on the other side. And again, I love being in the middle because you're in the middle of it and you can see everybody. But the old Victorian baths, from Bradford, we had Victorian baths, they were high-sided, so the waves used to hit the side and bounce in the middle.
Be a bit of pushback.
Yeah, and if you were in lane 1 and 8, it was a nightmare because it was like the North Sea. So in lane 4, it was a little bit quieter.
Right.
So, but that didn't matter.
In the thick of it, but it's a better channel.
Yeah.
Right, so you called it that, and you began with a small group.
Three of us, yeah.
And how did you start? How did you get business? How did it begin?
I think, first of all, people believed in us. It's really interesting. Finding one or two people. So the sports psychologists were already working in the corporate world. So they were moonlighting from Loughborough University.
Which is famous for sports.
Yeah, Loughborough University, great sport. And the head of department, Graham, who started Lane 4 with me, had been phoned up by 3M in Loughborough, who had a division there. And the head, a guy called David Cook, actually, was thinking laterally. He's thinking, look, I've got some high performers in business. I've got some 8 vice presidents running quite significant bits of the business. I think they're like elite athletes, they're high performers. I want to find out how they could be better at what they do. And so he rang the sports psychology department at Loughborough and said, I want the sports psychologist to come and talk to my vice presidents. And so Graham went to talk to them and did started to talk to them as if they were elite athletes, you know, with goals and pressures and trying to work in a team effectively and bringing to bear some of those techniques and tools that he taught people like me. And their performance improved significantly. I mean, hugely improved. And so David.
So there's a lot I want to unpack here. Right?
Yeah,
So it's a very interesting. You brought psychologists, from a university,
into
a technology business, and sports together. So it's an really interesting fusion.
Well, yeah, 3M, a very innovative organization anyway. So they were looking for a differentiator, looking for something a little bit different. So not, they didn't want somebody like me. And David told me this. He said, I don't want somebody like you, the rent-a-hero, coming to tell my guys your story and go, rah, rah, come on, you can do it. He said, I want to know what these guys taught you. So I want them to teach my guys the same thing.
Right. So what were the key things that you took to this team at 3M?
A lot of things around resilience. So, you know, the stuff that you can learn. So I definitely between my Olympic Games, 84 and 88, I learned how to handle pressure. I learned how to focus better. I learned to be more resilient. I learned to my self-belief, self-esteem and self-confidence fit together, because those are different, they're different. And so some of the stuff around my individual performance, but also how to work in a team. So team dynamics, how do you get the best out of people, where their skill set lies, and how do you have empathy and give and take within a team and create flow? So, right. You know, that sort of, if you like, individual and team dynamic stuff. And David was quite clear with me. He said, look, for the price, I could get you for an hour at lunchtime to talk to my guys and get these guys for a whole year.
Right.
Because the price point was very different. You were
on the speakers circuit. Yeah,
well, yeah. I'd done a few speakings. As I was, I was doing the talent jobs. My main job was head of talent development. But I get asked every now and again to do the speech.
Yes.
And he said, look, that's going to do so much. It's going to inspire. But actually, I want these guys, I want my people to change for the better and learn some new things. And their KPIs, their performance went sky high. And he said, that's a great, you should get these guys into business. He told me, he said, you should start a business with these two.
Well, I'm thinking, listening to you, and I'm sure other people listening will be thinking this too, is, well, I'd like to be more resilient. I'd like to be more focused. Yeah. Give us some tips. Re-advice. How do you do this? Does it take a year? What's the curriculum here? How do you become more resilient? Because clearly it's very important, as is focus.
Well, if
you, and you said getting into a flow state, which particularly focus.
Well, I mean, focus is interesting because it's practicing techniques which are looking at the internal narrative and the external. So what's externally going on around you that might distract you or cause you to pay a different attention, and what's internally. So what have you got in control of you around your thought process and patterns? So what you might listen for, what you might see, what you might be drawn to. It's a combination of the internal and external. So there's definitely work you can do on noticing what's shaping you and changing your point of view and the external, but then how you're reacting it internally.
Just being aware of that, I suppose.
There's an awareness piece. Yeah, awareness and then doing something about it. But the pressure, handling pressure is a big one because, you know, there's a source of pressure on everybody. Identifying what that source is, but then understanding how it affects you, and then having techniques to cope with the effects. So you sit in an Olympic final room. You sit half an hour before an Olympic final. You've got seven people with you.
You're there in your speedos.
In your speedo, or your tracksuit at that point. And they want to beat you, and you want to beat them. And you've got to wait half an hour, and there's 18,000 people outside.
You're all in the same room together.
We're in the same room.
Do you talk to each other?
It's a small room. Some people put headphones on. People walked around and just got very agitated. And
really,
so you then
you, about
then yeah. you're into meditation. Then you're into meditative practice. You're into breathing.
So what did you do in the room?
Quiet with my headphones.
Meditation.
Yeah, focus.
And then, what was playing in your headphones?
Oh, my headphones used like classical music actually at the time.
Right,
because I quite
so like. So you just sit there and listen to the music.
Replay. And then the other thing is not to. It's this thing about minimizing what's about to happen. So I could sit there and go, it's the Olympic Games, I've got to win the Olympics, it's a gold medal. It's, you know, but what I was thinking was actually none of that is currently in my control. So I'm not in the pool yet. So what's in my control? The next thing in my control is to walk out and get a good dive. So my tape in my head was thinking about the technique and the practice of getting in the water. Then everything will flow from there, rather than thinking, it's the Olympics. But then, and also,
so you were sitting in the room visualizing your dive into the pool.
And then the other thing was when I started to think about it's the Olympics, a big deal, everybody in the world. It's like, no, there's only seven people to beat now.
Right.
I don't have to beat those billions of people. I just beat most of them. I just got to beat seven. And I've beaten him before. And I know he's rubbish at the first bit. I can beat him.
Well, yeah, that's because he was good.
Then you're into self-talk then, aren't you? Then you're into actually, I think it's an interesting one with British.
So you're having a conversation with yourself.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with British people. That self-deprecation does undermine your confidence.
Right.
You know, don't get above yourself. Well, actually, you need to walk out thinking you're the best in the world and you're about to win. You have to.
Every day.
Why not? Yeah, no, but as long as, I mean, I'm from a good family that kept your feet on the ground. Arrogance never came into it. So there's a difference between.
Yeah, what's that? How do you manage that?
That's just, it's not, it's an internal thing, not an external thing. You don't have to go out and say, be cocky about it and go, that's usually hiding something, I think, that somebody is insecure. But if you are secure, it's inside.
Right.
You don't need to, so you're not perceived to be arrogant because you kind of just believe you're going to win.
Or you're setting out to win.
Yeah, and then if I fail, it's okay. Because I failed last time and I lived and I got over it. So my life will carry on.
Yes. But I mean, so when you, I mean, you didn't win every race, clearly. No. So when you didn't win, was that your take on it? Just that's just how it is today.
You'd analyse what went well and what didn't go well. It's a lot of reviewing.
Was that always in your control? I mean,
yeah, which bits were.
Yeah, because sometimes he's just a better swimmer, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but there's something about reviewing the process. I'm a big believer in all the inputs. It's the input that creates the output. Yes. So, you know, so what was I doing in the preparation of the room before? What was I doing on my diet? What was I doing with my nutrition? What was I doing? All those things are in my control. Rate myself. Sure, the result, that guy might have beat me on the day, but don't get hung up on that. Look at all the process. Where can you improve the process?
So you took these ideas or these thoughts into the world of business?
Yes.
Did you have to change it much? I mean,
so
how did you approach it? Yeah.
The two things about business for me were the product and the offer and the way I would lead the business. So the product and the offer was the psychology of performance, and that was individual, team, organizational. Get those guys to create dynamic consulting package or development packages that would work for the buyer, the client. But for me as a leader, thinking about how Lane 4 was created, I thought to myself, okay, if I'm the swimmer here, I'm a managing director, I don't know everything about everything. So as I did with swimming, with my nutritionist, psychologist, physiologist, I got, okay, legal, IT, HR, strategy, finance, get the best people. And then, so then you find, oh, that's my board. So I've got, right. I've got a board of experts who are very, very good at what they do. My job is not to do their job for them, it's to release their talent in a team. And so that really absolutely came from swimming. So when
there
I realized-
a really good team around you.
Absolutely, who are better than you.
That was because the first thing.
Yeah, nutritionist was miles better than nutrition than me. The psychologist was better than psychology than me. But the contribution to the whole, and that's exactly the same in business, have everybody feel that their contribution is critical, is valid, and it is. And then, so the entrepreneur thing is quite interesting because I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs try and do it all themselves. And that journey in swimming from being a kid through to the Olympic athlete that knew how to really work with a team of people and give up stuff and listen and be curious and apply and try and learn from that application. So that running the business was one thing. And then because these psychologists were very, very good, letting them loose on creating great product that fit the marketplace.
So what would be examples of the product that you would be selling at that time?
So early days, and then you say, why did everybody give us a go? They were curious about us, obviously. It's okay. But once they got over the fact it wasn't me trying to give them a talk, but actually I wanted these psychologists to work with them. And once they experienced it, then the word of mouth became very strong. We didn't market for 5 years. I wanted to make sure we had some strong case studies where the client said, this is really working for us. So
what would be the problem that you would be called in to help solve?
So it could be a high performer, it could be a team, it could be the top team, an executive team, or it could be team development. So how
so it's quite senior people.
Could be, yeah, we got senior people quite early on. Although you get mid managers, groups of people. How do they team well? How do people actually work well in a team? That's the individual dynamic and the team dynamic. I mean, latterly.
And what sort of intervention would you have delivered for that?
I think the skill set, a lot of the skill set was on facilitating conversations and bringing skills into the room. So new skills to learn. So different people doing things differently. Here's a methodology of doing something. Yeah. Try this. I'll give you an example. We work with some call center managers with BT actually. And one of their big metrics around handling calls right first time in the call center. And this, because we always ask the client what the metric is, because I want to win a race and swim a time. What's the metric? What are you trying to achieve? So we want to handle these calls better, handle them at 70% right first time. So what's going to be a good number? Well, 80% would be a good number. So you work with the call center managers to talk about handling pressure, setting effective goals. How are they goal setting? How are they causing pressure within the team? How are they responding? And give them some technique, some tools. Here's a framework that I could have learned around goal setting. Give them facilitate a conversation between them and say, would you apply this to your call center? And how might it affect your call center operatives to achieve a better number? And we did that for about a month, and their numbers went from 72% to 91% in a month, right first time. So their behavior changed because the skills they were learning and using, and they were applied, but nothing to do with sport. The sport was a nice hook.
That's what I'm wondering. It doesn't sound like it.
But it's a hook because
it gets you in the door.
Well, it is. But then I'll give you an example with the call center one. It's quite interesting because BT had Chris Hoy as an ambassador.
Right.
So what we said was, so can we use Chris? So he came on and talked for 10 minutes about handling pressure as a cyclist. Then the sports psychologist said, here's a technique Chris has learned. Here's what he did. And then one of us would facilitate a conversation with the call center guy and said, can you see how you would use that in your call center?
Right.
So inspiration, the tool, the application.
Right.
And so then, so you're hooking them with the
sport. Can you remember what that tool was?
That particular one was goal setting. That particular one was around, everyone was focusing on the performance number. Business is very, we all go on about the number. We've got to do 50 million, got to do this number. Yeah. But actually, it's the outcome and the process that matter. So why are you doing that number? What's that going to give you? Why would somebody, an 18-year-old, not 21-year-old in a call center care about that number? Give them more meaning in the number. Mm. And then the process, what's their role? Why is their role important to achieve that particular outcome? So getting to reframe the way they were talking about goals rather than his number.
So the goal would be theirs. It's
owned by the individual. They see how they fit into it and why it matters. And so very often people are very lazy in business with goals.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, there's a headline number, but people don't really know what's my part in this.
What's my part? And also what's it going to do for us? And that's why lots of people now, different generations, are asking for more meaningful work. What's the meaning? What's the point in doing this? We might do 50 million, but so what?
Yeah. What's our purpose? What's the point here? Why are we doing this? What's the point of business? Well, that's a very good question. So you grew this consultancy successfully over a 25-year period, huh?
We did. And as you have experienced the world of work in the last 25 years, there's been ups and downs.
Certainly have.
2008, 2009 was a big one.
I can remember them well.
2008 was a big one, yeah.
So what happened to you then? Was that an existential danger to you?
Yeah, it was. We stretched quite a bit. We had quite a few global clients. And we were working in 20 different countries, 20 different languages. We opened an office in New Jersey. We had clients in Manhattan and New Jersey. And we put 8 people in there. And we had an office in Melbourne serving Australasia and Singapore and KL, and we stretched on 2 continents. All the consultancy we had was going, like, do one at a time. But we went 2 because the client wanted us to do both.
But you had a particular client?
Yeah, and it took us very, very global. And then in the end, it was 2008, so the costs outweighed the revenue. And then
you had to close those offices?
Close both offices, yeah. Right. But that's the benefit, I think, of being small and entrepreneurial, is we could make those decisions together, and we made them very quickly. Because it was, UK business was fine, actually, in the 2008 period.
Yeah.
Just about. But we knew that it would hemorrhage money if we just kept the 2 offices open, so we closed them. So that was an interesting time, making our first redundancies and letting people go.
Difficult.
But very difficult, because despite everything I'm saying about the goal thing, it's a very heart-based business. Because if you work in human capital, you're working with people. Everything we do is to engage and enable people who are working at work. I want people to have a better day at work. That's why I do what I do.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, so do we. Yeah. I mean, that's why we do what we do, actually. Yeah, improving lives through work is our purpose. So how big did the company become?
We got about 25 million, about 250 people full-time, and about 300 associates around UK and the world. And it was pre-COVID, was going okay. And then, but a lot of our work was face-to-face, and COVID, we went a bit.
And then you made the decision to exit.
Yeah. We exited.
How did that come about? What was the... Sort of...
We were partnering. One of our big strategies was to create partnerships with some of the big four or consultancies that could take us into larger programs. Because at that point, we were doing a lot of transformation and change work. So how do you help an organization go through a big transformation project? How do you take the leaders and the organization through it at a human level? So how do you, you might want to change a system, or you might want to change a particular strategy, but how does the 30,000 people you employ do that and want to do that? So we were doing a lot of consulting work in that space. And we realized that piggybacking one of the big four would help us get into larger scale, the clients we could work with.
Yes.
And we started working with KPMG at one point for strategically, and then we got a big piece of work with civil service. And then we started working with EY on a piece with the Met Police in London when Cressida Dick was a commissioner leading for London. So an EY with a prime, because there was...
That's what sort of work you were doing for them, the police?
It was leadership, and it was all about... Right. It's everything that we're seeing of the boil being lanced now, right? So it's everything we're seeing, which is addressing... I mean, Cressida Dick as a commissioner, I thought was awesome. And just wanting to change the culture, the dynamic of everything that had been reported on and still is being reported on, but to try and help all those leaders do it better.
So you were supporting the
and helping them with conversations and training, developing, and but so we EY were prime and had the main contract, but we were the specialist that did the leadership work, all the way from desk sergeant to commissioner, and it was very rewarding, very challenging work, and it was during that time that EY said, "Look, we've got a partnership. You're working pretty much underneath our model. Do you want to join?"
Right.
That's pre-COVID. And we went, no.
No. That changed then, did it?
Yeah, after COVID.
Oh, right. Your tired. Negotiating position was somewhat weakened, I guess.
We're tired.
Right.
We had some friends to climb the mountain with, and so we joined.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, that was an incredible journey.
Mm.
And since then, now, you've sort of gone portfolio, and sort of for full disclosure, I should mention that I'm very pleased to say this, joined Reed as a non-executive director earlier this year, which we're delighted by. But you've got a sort of more portfolio career now, and you do a lot of mentoring with entrepreneurs.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm really interested in that.
Yeah, so and I'm very proud to be part of the Reed family as well, James. So thank you for inviting me. So yeah, doing that. And so I'm working with a small learning development company called Fieri. So I'm helping them with their strategy, helping them grow. I mean, that's sort of in the tent, if you like. But then I've got two or three other leaders of organizations, smaller organizations, who are wanting to shape their business and grow and achieve. And so helping them, having regular conversations, catch-ups, listening to their strategy, their choices, but trying to be the best of mentors, which is not a know-it-all, but somebody who actually asks questions and is curious and tries to hear what they actually want to find out about, rather than me spray painting it with my wisdom.
So you've got three, at least.
I've got about four. And then every now and again,
How often do you talk to them?
It depends on the phase. Sometimes it's once every 6 weeks. Sometimes it's every day.
Really?
It depends.
So it depends
what's going on. I don't charge for it.
You don't charge for it.
So they're people who I want to succeed. I'm in that altruistic phase.
But getting good value from you, whether you charge for it or not.
Hopefully, I don't know. It's good. I don't know.
Well, if you're doing it every day, you're certainly committed.
Sometimes.
To
it's just a call. Process. A call, yeah.
So what does it take to be a good mentor, do you think?
So I think I was touching on it a little bit there. So for me, mentoring and coaching are a little bit different. So if you're a mentor, you've trod the path before, possibly, and you've got things to offer. But the coaching style would say to the person, what do you actually want to hear? Rather than go, oh, I've done it all before, I'll tell you what you need to hear. But actually, I think a good mentor waits and listens and is curious and really, really understands the gaps and what the person is looking for. I've been on a panel before where they've had three people with experience and the people in the audience asking questions. And you just get the feeling that it's a bit of a showcase for somebody to say how good they are and what they've achieved. You know what I mean?
Yeah, people on the panel.
Yeah. And for me, it's more about, look, what's behind that question? Because they'll ask a question. So what's behind the question? What is it you're really asking and what are you concerned about? And then it's, okay, here's ask more questions back and then say, okay, I've had an experience similar. Would you like me to share that experience? Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Or maybe not that one, but something different. It gives them a chance to sort of really hone in where you're giving that particular advice, because I think advice comes with mentoring. But
so are you referring to your business experience quite a lot here, or your knowledge of psychology?
Well, it's a bit of both, actually. Leadership. It could be leadership experience, having being in the seat as you were, you know, being in the seat of a managing director of a small growing business. But it might be also the psychology I've learned, because I was very lucky, I think, because the product of my business helped me run my business better. Using it on myself was critical, because we were learning this stuff to share with our clients, but also we could use it on ourselves. And that was the real benefit.
Yes, because you said earlier that you felt you're a curious person by nature. So what did you learn about leadership that you used on yourself? What were the sort of takeaways there?
You can't force people to do stuff.
You can't force people to do stuff.
You can try and manipulate it with money, but extrinsic reward only takes you so far. So there is some part of that. But then the main bit is it's the heart. You've got to engage people's hearts. Leadership for me is having people understand what's happening, where you're trying to take the organization, but then also talk about why it matters and why might it matter to them, and engage them in what's the story of the organization. Then help them with the tools to be able to do something about it. And so for me, it was more about stories. It was more about painting a picture of what could be, being honest and realistic about what it was, what's happening, and then listening to different groups of people. You know, the board, just because you're on the board and you've got a position doesn't mean that you know everything. In fact, you probably don't. Understanding what's really happening in the organization is fundamental.
I think that's really interesting, and thinking about business, I completely concur. But what I've observed, interestingly, you go to a business conference, if a politician's speaking, they'll come in, do their speech, then leave. They don't listen to anyone else. And
isn't,
I think
that shame?
That's interesting. Well, I think it is a weakness in our sort of way politics works.
Yeah.
Because you learn so much from listening to the other people.
No, I agree.
And it's not really organized to do that somehow.
No.
Especially if you're in government. And I think that leads to less effective leadership.
No, absolutely. You've got to be in touch because if you have a strategy or have a plan, you know, it's not so going to survive contact with the enemy, is it? Unless you actually understand what's happening when it's in contact.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
The enemy in this case being other people.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
who are you trying to sort of influence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So plans only
take you so far, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And those plans need to be tested, refined with people who are actually going to enact them.
Yes.
So I believe in the full transparency organization, pretty much. I've been in some organization, I'm quite surprised about how much they want to keep quiet. And so you can share that. That can be shared.
Oh, yeah, but well, they don't want to tell them what their financial situation is.
Bits and pieces of it. There are certain parts of it because they're worried what people might think about it. Well, people talk about it anyway.
Well, it's very hard for things to be concealed now because there seems to be full transparency with the internet seems to have delivered that.
I mean, treating people like adults, right? Treating people like you're not their parent, because there's a lot of, in business, I think there's a lot of staging where you get a title and you decide you want to act like a parent, and therefore all the kids are the ones running the company.
Oh, you've observed this?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What sort of parent-child relationship?
Yeah, totally happens, yeah, a lot, yeah. And so you get a title, but that's what I mean. Leadership titles mean nothing, actually. What matters is the way you treat people.
Right.
And so people that hide behind the title to get something done are never going to get it done long-term.
So you can't force people to do things, and you shouldn't hide behind titles. Key lessons from Lane 4.
Well, from me.
I think they're good lessons. So if you really want to get people fired up behind an idea, how would you do that?
Find out what the ideas are percolating the organization. Work out what you think, because you might have a different view. You've got a helicopter view. Yeah, sure. And that's quite interesting, because you're lucky enough to be able to touch into lots of parts of your business. And so you maybe have got a bigger picture. But then test it and find the inspiring parts within the organization and see what is possible. And just ask somebody, is that possible if we did that? And then you can create an amalgam. And then it's all about narrative then. It's about how you engage people.
It's how you tell the story of what you're trying to do.
I think so. And how not be the sole storyteller. Then there's something about, that's what I mean, if people within the organization care about it enough, they'll start telling their version of the story. As long as the bones are the same. You hear the phrase bones, flesh and breath with a story? The bones of the story are, you know, the facts. That's kind of the things that you want to be shared out. But the flesh and breath is actually down to everybody to tell the story in their own way. It comes to life when the story's life breathed into it.
Yes.
And each individual does that in their own way. If they don't care, they're not going to do it. They're just going to share the bones.
Right. So if you're just seeing bones, there's a lack of care involved. But people aren't really... I mean, storytelling is in some sense so natural, but we're not taught how to do it necessarily at school. You know, we like reading stories, we like watching stories, sharing stories.
Yeah.
But it could be much more helpfully taught, I think, for people working.
I think so. And often there's confidence involved, isn't there? Whether people feel confident to speak out. And I think that's the other thing that you want to try and create in the organization, is that people don't feel silly saying anything. You don't make people feel stupid if they say something that's maybe off point or doesn't make so much sense. Just encourage them to talk.
I've observed and listened to sometimes
the team meetings, and you know, the manager will run the team meeting. They talk all the time, and then any questions at the end, and nobody says anything, and then they can't wait to get
off. The boss is doing all the talking.
Yeah.
The boss should talk last, shouldn't they?
Or not at all.
Or not at all.
Yeah, not at all.
I remember reading Nelson Mandela's wonderful book, A Long Walk to Freedom, and he talked about that.
Yeah.
know, how to get the best out of a group.
Yeah.
And you should go last. Yeah. Or you could summarize what's been
exactly.
said.
Exactly. It's your meeting. This is this team
You've
is you.
You've assembled this group to hear what they have to say, surely. Yeah. And that's often not the case in your experience.
Or it's getting better. It's getting a lot better. I think it's getting better.
Mm. Right. So as well as doing your mentoring, you said you had this consultancy. It sounded like you might be doing Lane 4 version 2. Leadership consultancy, Fiery, was it called?
Yeah, Fiery. So I'm helping them grow that business. And I mean, I don't have the same...
That fire's still inside you.
I've got probably not the competition thing. And I lost that a long time ago. I do believe that. I think what I realized was I enjoy making myself and the organization better every day. And if we win pitches, we win stuff. But actually, it's more about feeling that you've done a world-class job. So there's something about I really enjoy the process of business. I like doing business. And I don't necessarily win some, lose some sort of thing. But... I'm also equally I've got a role as the chairman of a local trust in Windsor Maiden where I live, the Leisure Focus, who run the leisure facilities in my community, and working with the chief exec there to create a better, healthy community matters to me a lot, actually. And we've started to look at parts of the business, parts of that organisation that can earn money for the foundation, for the trust. So we're creating something a little bit more entrepreneurial within the boundaries of a community for the benefit of the community, but also the benefit of the trust.
So what sort of activities would those be?
So, they're legitimate business activities, right? So, well, running a swim school is one thing. Back to the old roots. Tom Dean swim school.
Everyone should learn to swim.
So a swim school, there's a media business, a facilities business, training business. So all the bits that you would expect within a leisure organization, but for the benefit of the trust and the community.
And that recycles money into the community.
Absolutely. And I don't know when one gets to a stage in one's career or life where it's like you want to put that stuff back. You know, you really want to make a difference. All my children grew up in that community, and my friends and their children and people I know and people I'm attached to.
This sounds like a model that could be recreated up and down the country, though.
Yeah, well, hopefully,
other communities could.
There are a number of trusts-run local leisure facilities rather than private organisations.
You could create that business model.
That business model, it exists. But what I'm interested in is the dynamic interplay between for-profit and not-for-profit.
Right.
And because running the charitable business or the foundation, and as Reed does, and also having the for-profit businesses that fund the good activities within the community.
Right. Well, I wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Is there anything? I mean, I'm still sort of wondering in my mind. I don't know what the question is really. The sort of overlay between sports and business.
Right.
You know, people talk a lot about athletes and performance and teams, and then you do get speakers like yourself I've heard speakers from the sporting world, and they're great to listen to. But I do sometimes leave thinking, how's that going to help me do my job better, or what am I going to do with this bit of information? I mean, I've heard a great story, I've enjoyed the hour. But so how much do you think they are sort of overlapping, and maybe what areas are they not?
So it's really interesting, because when I first met Graham, the professor of psychology from Loughborough University, I watched him do his thing with the 3M guys, and he watched me do a talk. And at the end of my talk, he said, "That was interesting, but so what?" So he did exactly that. It's sort of harsh, but it became a business partner.
From a business point of view, I sometimes feel that.
But it's totally right. It's totally right, because there is a difference between inspiration and inspiring somebody. So I can listen to a mountaineer, I can listen to a sportsman, I can listen to a paralympian, I can listen to an entrepreneur, I can listen to anybody give me an inspirational conversation and be moved. When you're inspired, I think the definition is to be moved emotionally or mentally. So it stimulates your thinking, or it stimulates your emotion. Mm. Whether you do anything about it is down to you. So therefore, you're attacking motivation then. So that's about small habits, doing things differently every day. So if you heard something where the guy or the lady said, here's something about goals, you have to then do something differently in your day-to-day activity with goals. Otherwise, it won't change. Mm. And having a coach or somebody to work with to hold you to account. Or if you're in business, that's the manager and the employee. So I think for me, going back to your question, the similarity in business and sport, or music, or in the military, any parallel you want to play, is that we're all human beings. Full stop. Right. Bottom line, we're all human beings, and we're all trying to do something differently or better. So in sports case, you're trying to swim a bit, run a bit, whatever. But in business, you're trying to do that piece of design better, run this program better, film better. You're still trying to do something. You're doing a job. It just happens to be in a different sphere. And right. So what you do is, so the sport, yeah, I don't like the just the rent a hero thing. Come and do this.
Rent a hero.
Yeah, I don't like that. No. And so for me, it's more about what can you do differently and where's that technique going to come from? It could come from a business book. It could come from a sport. It could come from a university business school. It could come from...
That's what's so interesting about your origin story with Lane 4, that it came from those various places.
And it is an interesting because Fieri is ex-military. So the guys I'm working with now were ex-military. And so
how does leadership... Because I've always probably wrongly assumed that in the military, you do just sort of tell people what to do.
Very different dogma. Very different now. Huge difference. In Sandhurst... Oh, yes. And Matt, the guy that runs Fieri, was part of the Sandhurst Leadership Academy there, helping...
So has the military been influenced by sport and business then?
You're curious... It's a total mixed bag. If you're curious, you're interested in what an orchestra can teach. You're interested in what the military... Yeah. So you don't close your mind to think it may be just they just walk on and tell people to shoot each other.
All these entrepreneurs used to read Sun Tzu, The Art of War. Yeah. I don't know. It was an ancient Chinese text. But I remember the one phrase I remember from it, to win without fighting is best.
Yeah.
So that's quite a useful lesson.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think if you're curious, you won't have that filter on... Will this give me anything? You're going to be open-minded and you're listening. And you're right, there might be... It's like a jigsaw and collecting pieces for a jigsaw, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you might go to that thing and part of some training or listen to somebody or read a book. You might get 5 pieces of the jigsaw and then you might...
So you're a bit of a magpie. You pick
and you might get 100 pieces somewhere over here. And so...
Yeah, so you should be looking and curious.
Absolutely.
See what you can learn from wherever.
Yeah.
Because there will be lessons.
And try and apply it and then learn from applying it, failures, successes.
You've talked quite a bit about goal setting. I'll ask you a personal question. Do you set yourself a goal every day?
No.
So it's not like, because I was beginning to get the impression this is something I should be doing on a daily basis. No, that's reassuring.
Yeah. No, I'm quite laid back.
I'm quite laid back. But yeah. Where should we be on that? You know, so should we all have goals in life or different stages? You know,
I think we all do, but we all have goals. They either go from the grand or the small. The small goal might be, I need to go to the toilet. Or it might be, I need to eat some food because I'm hungry.
Oh, they qualify those things.
Well,
okay,
it will move you to behavior. So a goal moves you to an action, usually. That's right. What you need.
Okay.
So if the goal is...
So we do all have goals.
We all have goals all the time. Yeah. But then they kind of get a bad rap sometimes when you go... If it's just a financial...
So what do you think about, you know, BHAGs, the Jim Collins, big, hairy, audacious goals? You know, we should have some great goal, you know, make a £1 billion business or, you know, raise 50 million or whatever it for charity. Is that healthy or is it a kind of a distraction?
I like the big, hairy, audacious goal because I was a child of 12 that had one and did it. So I believe they're possible.
You were one of...
I was 12.
Oh, yeah.
When I watched David Wilkie win the Olympics.
David Wilkie.
I want to win the Olympics. And at 12, that's a big hairy.
So you saw that as a 12-year-old. Okay.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I'll do that.
So you set yourself that goal at 12.
Exactly.
How old were you when you won?
24.
So 12 years later, you did it.
Yeah. So but I'm a big fan of big, audacious goals because everything that is achieved in the world is done by somebody who's dreamt it.
Right.
Who didn't think it was possible. I remember my coach told me that when I was 14. I shared this goal with him. I said, "Okay." He said, "Why you come swimming?" Because I was always, always complaining. I was about last in the pool. Yeah. I said, "I want to win the Olympics," and I never shared it with anybody. He said, "That's a great goal." He said, "But you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow.
Right?
It's going to take some time." He said, "But what he said was, the people that will win those Olympics in about 10 years' time are all 12, 13, 14 year old children today, who are dreaming about it."
Yeah.
Also, all the people that do it will have dreamt it in the first instance. So why not?
Yeah.
What a great goal.
What an inspiring coach.
Well, indeed, because he was going...
He didn't say, you do another length.
But going back to your question about the BHAG, for me, if it is a do 50 million, 2 billion, I don't like that bit of it because I don't believe they are useful in and of themselves as goals. I think that...
Well, those big numbers. Businesses have that.
It's more what sort of business you want to create, what sort of impact you want to have on the world, or your consumer or whatever. What's meaningful, what's exciting at a heart-based level? Because there's not many people going to be excited by 50 million.
No, it's meaningless. A few people, it's just an abstract.
So it's like my coach saying to me, when you say, I want to win the Olympics, he says, well, you've got to swim 60 seconds. And every day, you've got to swim 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Terry. You've got to swim 60 seconds. We're going to enter the Olympics. Hey! Okay, because I do believe...
So it should speak much more to the heart in that sense.
Yeah. But why would we want to do that? Why would we want
It's like a moonshot. Yeah, we're going to put a person on the moon. Or
exactly.
Whatever. Yeah.
But they're all right. I mean, I think when we get a bit older, we kind of... The edges get a bit smoothed off because we have some failure and we kind of don't think we should be dreaming about things. But I bet everybody walking down the street has got some form of, I'd like to, but they probably haven't shared it.
Yes. Yeah, what's your dream? There's a good book on that subject, which I read this summer. No, that's brilliant. Now, that's very helpful to have that explanation from you around goals, which I found very useful.
Thank you.
Is there anything else about leadership? You know, when you look around in the world now, I mean, it's quite a sort of testing environment. People don't feel particularly sort of encouraged. Is there anything you think could be done differently or anyone who could step up in a different way or anything that you might, if you were a mentor, say, come on, do this or think about that?
I think if I look at leadership and right now in the world, it's pretty dispiriting when you see what's happening with some of the world's leaders and the way they're conducting themselves.
Yes.
And for me, I think people need to be maybe a bit more curious and just be, rather than following people blind and listening, you need to really understand what's going on and challenge it and be prepared to stand up. And I think that action is the only way it's going to change because, you know, that we need different types of leaders in positions. We don't need some of the ones we've got.
So that's a very good sort of challenge to everyone listening, that we should all be more curious to find out actually what's really going on. That's your sort of message.
It is. I can't believe that so many people blindly follow or listen to some of the stuff that comes out of some of the leaders' mouths. I can't believe it.
It is sort of unbelievable. I agree.
Yeah.
So there you are. That's a call to action, Adrian. Let's all be more curious and stand up and be counted as well. Make the case heard for what you think is right and what is actually happening.
Yeah.
So, Adrian, I'm curious, are there any sort of common leadership challenges you see amongst entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones is letting go, is trusting other people to take your baby or your dream and bring their particular skill and viewpoint to it. I think very often the thing that stops entrepreneurs growing is they've got a very definite view on what this thing should be. Not that they're wrong, because actually some of the entrepreneurs that start with great ideas are fantastic and they've got great ideas, but recognize that you can't be a control freak in an entrepreneur business, I don't think. And too many people want to hold it tight. I think you've got to find some good people and trust them, give them a go, share. Share your birthday cake.
Right. So you've got to get better at delegating often, though.
And it's not easy because I think that, you know, you've got an idea and you think you're often the only one that's done that or can do it and you know how to do it. And you've just got to let other people learn and grow and come up with you.
And they might make some mistakes.
Yeah, they might not do it the way you do it, but you know what? It might be better than the way you would have done it.
Yeah. So that's a key message.
I think it's huge. I'm noticing that a lot. I do notice that with entrepreneurs. There are phases where you go so far, and that is the first barrier I think they face is to growth, is to let go.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming to talk to me. I always ask two questions at the end of my guests. They're all the same question, because at Reed, we love Mondays. The first question, Adrian, is what gets you up on a Monday morning?
I love Mondays.
You love Mondays?
Yeah, I love them. Yeah, for me, I get up at 5 anyway. I can't stop getting up at 5 o'clock. That's when I get up for swimming and that's when I get up. So what gets me up is it's a new day. I like the morning. I like the part of the day before anybody else gets up. What should we look for?
What do you do at 5 o'clock?
I read and I just have a gentle start today and then maybe go to swimming and maybe...
Do you still swim?
Yeah, because only a couple of times a week. I go to the gym as well.
I think healthy you still body, qualify as an elite athlete.
I'm far from elite.
No, you are in my mind. And then lastly, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Oh, 5 years' time. Hopefully still alive. That'd be great. But 5 years' time, I think I'll still be working because I quite like what I do.
So I think working.
So some form of work. Maybe it's my children will have all gone So they'll have left the home by then. Maybe not. Maybe they've all come back again. I don't know. So yeah. It'd be quite interesting to be present. I love being a dad. So I think that in 5 years' time, I want to carry on being the best dad I could be alive and still working in the things I love doing.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you success in all of those things. Thank you, Adrian. And thanks so much for coming in to talk to me, which was both inspiring and informative. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Adrian, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Adrian's work in performance development, or his coaching and advisory roles, you'll find all the links in the show notes. See you next time.